The U.S. says Christians are under attack in Nigeria and responded with airstrikes on ISIS targets there, a response that may not address a complex situation.
I don't think that striking them is going to bring the conflict to an end automatically. No, it is going to further radicalize.
I'm Marco Werman. Today, some perspective on violence in Nigeria. Also, why parts of England are being called dental deserts.
People are having to resort to pliers and a bottle of gin to alleviate toothache. It shouldn't happen.
Plus, comfort soup in Portugal.
It's like coming home to a hug.
And kids everywhere are into tobacco pouches. Our intrepid reporter couldn't resist the experience of snus.
So it could maybe make you feel dizzy or something like
that. It might.
All today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you here today. Carolyn Beeler has the day off. We begin in Nigeria, following U.S. airstrikes launched on Christmas Day in the northwestern part of the country. President Trump called the strikes a targeted attack on the Islamic State and claims the U.S. acted in response to a recent wave of conflict in Nigeria. The Trump administration has framed that violence as targeting Christians, a characterization Nigeria itself largely rejects. The reality on the ground is complex. Onyedikachi Madueke is an analyst based in Scotland and studies security in Africa. When we spoke earlier today, I asked him whether the Islamic State, or IS, is active in Sokoto State, where the strikes took place.
Some report shows that they are penetrating Sokoto State from the Sahel. So that is something that is being monitored, but it has not become full-blown, like we have Boko Haram and all of that.
So that's interesting. Sokoto State is in the northwest of Nigeria, and the recent wave of violence and kidnappings that the Trump administration is concerned about, it happened in a different part of Nigeria, right?
Yeah, so the one Trump administration is talking about, I mean, that conflict is taking place in North Central. And it involves largely Christian farmers and armed Fulani
herders.
They look after cattle bearers. They're nomadic in nature. So in search of grazing field for their cattle, they often move down south. And the North Central is a boundary region with the southern Nigeria. And the people there are mostly Christians and are mostly farmers. Now, in the course of looking for grazing field, the cattle rearers often destroy the crop of these farmers. And the farmers in retaliation fight them. And then this conflict ensues.
What I hear you saying, Onyedikachi, is that the narrative of Muslim violence on Christians is an incomplete picture in Nigeria, but it's one that the U.S. is leaning into. Do we know if there's a connection between these IS fighters in the Northwest and the violence that's been happening across Nigeria?
Yeah, so there is no direct correlation between the two. But what we do know is that the two regions are far away from each other. And the ISIS, they are quite different from these herders. And the place Trump administration targeted, Sokoto State, the victim of the attacks in that state are mostly Muslims. So probably up to 85% of the population of Sokoto is Muslim. So if you throw a bomb into the market, you are likely to kill mostly Muslims than Christians. So Trump administration carried out an airstrike there. And many Nigerians welcome it.
Well, what is your understanding of the range of reactions to these airstrikes so far across Nigeria? What are you hearing?
So it's mixed reaction. If you go to Sokoto State, illiteracy rate is high, poverty rate is high, so people don't have access to information. So, and they immediately see themselves as targeted. But elsewhere, Nigerians are happy. They say, we are tired of the insecurity. We are tired of the kidnappings. We need solution. The Nigerian security forces are overstretched. The government is not doing well enough in terms of providing a solution to this crisis. They are very much open and welcome to anything that brings respite. They say this is good as far as they're coming to help us take away the terrorists, but don't frame this as Muslims attacking Christians. It doesn't explain the whole security crisis in Nigeria.
Yeah, so as you've made clear, it is a complicated picture, both religion-wise and socially in Nigeria. I mean, just hours after the U.S. strike on IS a few days ago, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth said that more strikes are coming. If the U.S. continues without an accurate picture of the complex reality on the ground, what are the risks, in your opinion?
The risk escalating the conflict.
How so?
Now U.S. struck, the insurgents are going to go back to their drawing board, change tactics. And I don't think that striking them is going to change, bring the conflict to an end automatically. No, it is going to further radicalize them. It's going to even harden them the more. So targeted strike can achieve a temporal victory, you know. But the long-term solution lies on understanding the complexities, the nuances of the conflict in Nigeria.
Onyedikachi Madueke is an analyst based in Scotland and studies security in Africa. By the time the Vietnam War ended in 1975, millions of people had lost their lives. American soldiers accounted for about 50,000 of those deaths. Vietnam paid a much higher price, 3 million dead, in some cases soldiers dying as they fought alongside U.S. troops. After the war, many survivors fled the country and resettled across the U.S. Heidi Shin brought us a story of a Vietnamese community in Boston trying to put their stories front and center in a new memorial.
Hung Vu served as a lieutenant in the South Vietnamese Army in the 1970s. He was just a young man back then with a big vision for rebuilding Vietnam. But when Saigon fell in 1975, he became a political prisoner instead, and that hope was lost. We're sitting at his kitchen table in Fields Corner. The wall behind the fridge is covered with I voted stickers and reminders for community meetings. He's come a long way since the communist reform period in Vietnam in the 1970s. He was sent to a re-education camp then, which was essentially a prison in the woods. The memories from that time still make him shudder. In the prison camp, Vu says he was subject to brutal forced labor, disease, hunger, for a sentence of 7 years. This because of his ties to the South Vietnamese government. I was lucky enough to make it out alive, he says. But some of his friends died in these labor camps. Eventually, Hung Vu was released. He and his family joined the nearly 800,000 Vietnamese who migrated to the U.S. in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. He was granted a humanitarian HO visa as a labor camp survivor. Here in the U.S., Vietnam veterans are honored on national holidays. But these memorials don't mention the Vietnamese Americans who fought alongside the U.S. and then became U.S. citizens.
And I'm always at this site in Dorchester where there's 79 American soldiers' names, but no Vietnamese names. And so the trauma, the grief, the lived experience is still very much there.
That's Nhoc Tran Vu. She's Hung Vu's daughter and an artist in Boston. She and her colleague, Lin Phang Vu, set out to build a memorial, a public art installation that would tell stories like her dad's. It's a project called 1975, a Vietnamese diaspora commemorative initiative.
What sets this memorial apart is that it's told from the perspective of Vietnamese. It should shift it towards the impact of war on families and communities.
Tran Vu shows me around Townfield Park in Fields Corner, Boston. It's one of the potential sites for the new memorial, pending city approval. Nearby, there are pho noodle shops, bubble tea, a Buddhist temple, and triple-decker houses. This is one of the largest Vietnamese-American communities in the Northeast. Tran Vu tells me about plans for the memorial design. There are no war generals on horses here.
intentionally is the banyan tree, which is also known as the ancient tree in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. So it's
unlike the typical war memorial, Tran Vu says this project is community-driven. The design team has been hosting meetings with local Vietnamese Americans across generations. And as it turns out, they don't always agree on a lot of things.
Our elders have lived through the war. Some are boat refugees themselves. They're like, we want the boat to be represented.
Whereas young people, largely born here and raised here in the U.S. as Vietnamese Americans, want something else.
And young people leaning towards more like the healing.
The representation of hope. In other words, they want to build a community identity that goes beyond war and trauma. Their politics and perspectives might be different from their parents. They want to focus on resilience and their new lives and how they contribute to American culture and the economy. The 1975 project will also include a collection of oral histories led by project director Lin Phuong Vu. She's an instructor at UMass Boston in the Asian American Studies program, and she's been working with her students who are second and third generation Vietnamese Americans to collect these stories.
Oftentimes they tell me that the Vietnam War is a small little section in the U.S. history textbook. It's very, they talk more about the humanitarian efforts.
So instead of meeting on the UMass campus, Lynn brings her students into Fields Corner, where we are now. Here, her students interview shopkeepers, community leaders, Vietnamese American grandparents about being Vietnamese refugees.
These stories are literally blowing their minds about what the history actually really truly was.
A lot of those were the darker side of the stories, right?
Angelina Nguyen is a UMass student. She had an uncle who survived the labor camps, and her parents fled Vietnam by boat as teenagers.
Women who were on the boats would be robbed by pirates, or raped at worst, or thrown overboard, even.
The elders they interview are like stand-ins for their own parents, who they may not hear these stories from. It helps them to humanize their parents and to understand their PTSD triggers.
There's this, like, gap that, like, we just couldn't understand each other. The fact that I'm able to understand them now, I'm able to give them that grace that I wasn't able to give them before.
Lin Vu is also trained as a mental health clinician. And she knows that asking someone to tell a difficult story can actually re-trigger their trauma. So she's really careful about this process.
We don't just go in and collect these stories and say, okay, thank you, and then leave. We should be checking in. We're always checking. We are in the community.
Last month, Tran Vu and Lin Vu hosted an event to remember the fall of Saigon on April 30th, 1975. It's a day known as Black April. It was at a high school in Boston with hundreds of attendees, girls in white tunic dresses, elders in military uniform. Boston's Mayor Michelle Wu was there. There was music, dancing, art. Lin Vu and her students created an interactive exhibit using what they'd heard and learned to depict the various stages of a refugee's journey. Student Angelina Nguyen gives me a tour. As visitors enter the large, dark room, each is given a glass jar with lights to be used like a lantern. We pass through a dark tunnel of newspaper clippings from the war. We hear radio reports.
South Vietnam now is under communist control. The last president of Vietnam, General Minh, has been arrested.
We see a refugee suitcase, a 10-foot escape boat, GI uniforms, a map where visitors can mark their own refugee journeys. Earlier, Tran Phu's father, Hung Vu, said that he wanted to protect his children from his past traumas. But now, after having shared these memories, he's changed his mind. He said he's relieved and happy. It gives him hope to see the work that young people are doing with all its possibilities. At the end of the tour, visitors add their small lanterns to a whole wall of jars illuminated with light. The exhibit seems to say it's possible to do both, to remember the war and to celebrate the strength and resilience of refugee and immigrant communities. To celebrate being Vietnamese American here in the U.S. For the world, I'm Heidi Shin, Fields Corner, Boston.
In Sweden, a bad habit repackaged for a new generation. It's still a bad habit. That's later this hour. You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In 2026, Europe will be trying something new to address climate change. The continent is implementing the world's first carbon tariff. It's a pretty radical move to reduce carbon emissions, not just in Europe, but in all the places that do business with Europe. Starting January 1st, EU tariffs on imports like steel, cement, and aluminum will be calculated in proportion to how much carbon is emitted to produce those materials. Policymakers across the globe will be watching because this new approach could be effective environmentally, but it could also backfire geopolitically. We'll hear why in today's installment of The Big Fix, where we dig into the most ambitious efforts underway to deal with climate change. Aaron Cosby is our guest. He's an economist in British Columbia. He says his tariff addresses a gap in existing policy.
They have had a carbon price in place in Europe since 2005, actually. They are now moving to make it a more onerous and meaningful price between now and 2034. But they're afraid that a carbon price on their local production, for example, of steel and aluminum, that the result will not be a decarbonization of those industries. They'll actually just be outcompeted by producers from other countries that don't have a carbon cost. That's the reason they're now moving to put in place this border measure.
And 2034 is when the whole plan kind of goes into 100% effect. Is that right?
That's right. So the CBAM starts on January 1st, 2026, but it starts gradually. It will start at 2.5%. It ramps up to 100% in 2034, at the same time as scaling back the cost containment mechanisms in 2034.
So what Europe is introducing with this carbon border adjustment mechanism, the CBAM, it's a global first. You kind of laid out the calendar there. How is it going to actually work?
The regulation says, basically, if you're importing steel, you're importing cement, fertilizers, hydrogen, or aluminum, or electricity, you're going to have to declare how much you imported, and you're going to have to declare how much greenhouse gases were embodied in the products that you import. And that's not an easy thing to calculate. But once you've calculated it, then you have to pay for each ton of greenhouse gases the equivalent that you would have had to pay if you were a European producer. And you have to remit that to the European Commission.
So now producers abroad are going to be taking a hit. I mean, we've just heard all this discussion during COP30 and past COPs about how the burden of dealing with climate change falls unevenly and some say unfairly on the developing world. Isn't this in some way adding to their burden?
It is adding to their burden in two different ways. One, you pay the price at the border. So if you're a particularly high greenhouse gas intensive foreign producer, you're going to lose market share in the European Union. So that's a cost, right? South Africa and India are paying that cost. But the more palpable cost for a lot of producers is just the whole process of complying. You have to put in place a greenhouse gas emissions intensity accounting system in your regime. You have to go back upstream to all your suppliers and ask them what their greenhouse gas intensity was. You have to make these reports, and they're not easy reports to make. And then you have to pay somebody to verify that the reports are accurate. All of that, for many industries, is actually a more significant cost. And that gets borne whether you're clean, whether you're dirty, no matter what. And it falls more heavily on small exporters and exporters from developing countries that probably don't already have to do that kind of GHG accounting reporting.
So, Aaron, I think it's fair to ask, what is the ultimate goal here for Europe, money or decarbonization?
Well, if you ask them, it's definitely not the money. They say that they would like eventually not to be collecting anything. They would like everybody to have a carbon price. And to be fair, if you look at what they're doing, there are about 70 different national carbon pricing regimes around the world, taxes or emissions trading systems like what the EU has. Absolutely none of them is doing what they're doing. The European Union is really going out as a pioneering effort on this one.
Yeah, let me jump on what you just said there. Where else in the world is this kind of carbon tariff being considered, and why are they not jumping on it like Europe is?
The UK has announced that they will do one as of 2027. Norway similarly has announced that. It's being explored in Canada, in Australia. They've put one in place in Chinese Taipei. They've put one in place in Thailand. But the limiting thing here is you really don't need one of these things unless you have a particularly high carbon price. So I live in Canada. We have a carbon price. It's not so high yet that we have to worry about this stuff. We have a nice cost containment mechanism. It works, and it's going to continue to work until we make a very high and meaningful carbon price.
Well, as time marches on with carbon emissions continuing to flow out, is it inevitable that these tariffs will have to be considered by a lot of countries?
That's $1 million question. The problem is, it makes sense to think about putting a regime like this in place. And on an intuitive level, it sounds simple enough. You put a price at the border that's equivalent to what you're charging your domestic producers. It's anything but simple. The regime that the EU is trying to put in place, I don't think they anticipated how complicated, how difficult, how challenging it would be just to administer, not to mention the political blowback they're getting from their trading partners.
Why is carbon pricing seen as effective?
It's basic economics, right? If you put a price on carbon, less of it will be produced. It boils down to that. If you're a steel producer and you've got a carbon price, all of a sudden you have to factor that into your investment decisions, and it may make sense to put in place energy efficiency investments, even retrofits for different technologies that wouldn't have made economic sense if there hadn't been a carbon price there.
Is it actually an effective way, though, to decarbonize industries at scale? Or is this one of those, it's good on paper, but less so in practice kind of thing?
It's undeniably effective at marginal improvements, at energy efficiency improvements, at those kinds of nibbling away at the edges of your emissions improvements. If you're, for example, a steel producer thinking about completely revamping your production to get near zero, that's a different production route. It's a different technology. It's been argued that the carbon price by itself is not enough. It's a good thing, it's essential, but by itself, it's not enough.
So just to bring the policy itself up to the most recent news, the EU actually expanded what the carbon tariff will apply to, not just cement and steel, but covering more downstream products, everything from washing machines to industrial radiators. Why did they do that?
Their fear was, if you're a washing machine manufacturer, you're buying the steel from either an EU producer or you're importing it, but now it's going to be more expensive to buy that steel, whether you buy it from the EU, whether you buy it from a foreign producer. So you're paying more for your steel. That means your final washing machine is going to cost more too. Not by a lot, but perhaps by enough that it makes you vulnerable to competitive risks from other washing machine manufacturers. So somewhere you have to draw that line. You got to cut that off, depending on what risks you see for competitiveness. The EU apparently decided that washing machines were risky enough that they needed to cover them.
So, Aaron, what are you going to be watching for as the new year gets underway and this new EU carbon tariff takes hold?
Well, I'll be watching to see how effectively they can implement this thing. I'll be watching to see if they expand it to more sectors. And it's also interesting to think how they're going to deal with the problem of, it's called resource shuffling. You know, when you put a regime like this in place, what might happen is you just get a rejigging of world trade such that all the clean stuff that was already being produced now gets shipped to the EU and the dirty stuff gets shipped elsewhere. You haven't really changed anything. That's a problem, and it's not clear how they're going to address that one either.
Aaron Cosby is an economist with the International Institute for Sustainable Development. More global stories still coming your way. Stay with us. You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Going to the dentist, definitely not at the top of many wish lists. The pain, the scraping, the drill. Just the sound of it. But you know what's worse? Not being able to go to the dentist. This is a problem in England. A shortage of dentists with the National Health Service has people desperate for appointments. Some are even taking matters into their own hands. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry explains.
Leila Waters rang dozens of dental surgeries within a 70-mile radius of her home when one of her back teeth got infected. She lives in Peterborough in the east of England. She was in agony, she told them over the phone. But each time, Waters was told, there were no appointments available. Eventually, she decided to tackle the problem herself.
I got a bit of kitchen roll and I covered the tooth and I just pulled. Strained my eyes and pulled until it was out.
The pain was indescribable, Waters told ITV Television in England recently.
I almost passed out. It was unbelievable. But all I could think about was the relief at the end of it, because I just couldn't carry on the way that I was.
And Waters isn't alone. Health Watch England, a patient watchdog, reported this month that people with dental emergencies are now travelling more than 100 miles to try and access NHS treatment. Others are going private, and some are resorting to using a set of pliers. Under Britain's national health system, if you're in pain, you should be able to get an emergency appointment within 24 hours, or up to 7 days, depending on your symptoms. But a severe shortage of NHS dentists means that's not happening.
Nobody wants to work in a system that they see as broken.
Vijay Sudra is an NHS dentist working in Birmingham. He's been with his practice for almost 30 years. And unlike the majority of dentists in England, he doesn't do any private work.
It's a really simple, hardworking, poor community. They are great people. And you know what? I don't go to work for the money. I enjoy the job. I find it very satisfying.
Most of his patients could never afford private care, he says, and he believes passionately in Britain's public healthcare system. But government contracts with NHS dentists are so bad, he says, that it's driving many of his colleagues into the private sector.
If I do 3 fillings, or if I do 10 fillings, I'm going to get paid the same amount of money. It's capped per case. The funding.
So Sudra says a patient with very complex dental needs ends up essentially costing the dentist money. The lack of dentists working for the NHS means parts of the country are now known as dental deserts, where it's almost impossible to get an appointment. This month, the British government proposed a change to the way dentists are paid, offering them better incentives to take on longer, more complex treatments. Rebecca Harris, Professor of Dental Public Health at the University of Liverpool, says it's a good start.
These reforms that have recently been announced, they were broadly welcomed across the profession. Will this fix it completely? Probably not. Will it help stabilise the situation? It will help.
But persuading dentists to come back and work for the NHS, she says, that's a very tall order.
What you find is that once people have left to work in the private sector, it's a very rare occurrence for them to come back and work again in the public sector in the NHS.
Government Health Minister Stephen Kinnock also proposed another solution to try and boost the number of emergency appointments available.
A lot of people are being called in on the NHS to do checkups every 6 months, and that's not the right use of dentists' time. And it's also sucking up a lot of the money in NHS dentistry in the contract into routine care.
Kinnock said routine checkups should be offered every 2 years instead to those with good oral health. Dentist Vijay Sudra isn't so sure that'll work.
The problem with that is what happens, and we saw this when we were coming out of the pandemic. I had patients who were regulars, who were seen every 6, 12, 9 months. I didn't see them for 2.5 or 3 years. And when they came in particular, their gum condition had deteriorated significantly.
Sudra says much more investment is needed if dentists are to stay working for the NHS. Successive governments, he says, continue to fail dentists and their patients.
It's a shocking indictment that today, in nearly 2026, people are having to resort to pliers and a bottle of gin to alleviate toothache. It shouldn't happen in a first world nation.
His biggest fear, Sudra says, is when he's ready to retire, there'll be no one left to pass the drill on to. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Nicotine pouches may seem like a trendy new thing, but they're pretty similar to what used to be called dip. Tobacco placed right under the lip. Pouches are the same idea, except they're just the nicotine without the tobacco, and they come in fancy flavors. One brand from Sweden is especially popular. As The World's Joshua Koh recently learned on a trip to Sweden, the country takes its relationship with the stuff seriously.
The popularity of Swedish nicotine pouches like Zyn has given rise to Zynfluencers in the U.S.
Trying Zyn from Sweden, part one. This one's called Lemon Spritz. This can's pretty cool. Look how thick that can is.
I'm trying Zyn from Sweden. In Sweden. To be precise, I'm inside the flagship store of Swedish Match, a Stockholm-based tobacco company now owned by Philip Morris, and the maker of Zyn. Patrick Stromer is showing me how it's done. To start, I place the pouch up under my lip, an upper decky, as the kids say.
Let it stay there.
Mm-hmm.
If you're getting dizzy, take it out. You're not supposed to feel bad about this.
Okay, so it could maybe make you feel dizzy or something like that.
It might.
Stromer is Secretary General of the Swedish Association of Snus Manufacturers. In Sweden, there's a catch-all term for pouches like the one in my mouth. It's called snus. And there are two main types of snus, the traditional sort with tobacco and the new stuff, nicotine-only pouches. That's where Zyn is a big player on the market.
I can kind of feel it burning a little bit. Right, is it just like...
Yeah, and that's the... you have a higher pH than neutral in these products to release the nicotine. And
as Stromer explains how the alkaline chemistry of snus makes it easier for nicotine to move from the pouch through the soft tissue of my gums and inner lip and into my bloodstream, I start to feel a buzz. My heart beats faster and faster, and my mind, it starts to feel focused and sharp. After a very long morning train to get across the country to Stockholm, I'm not going to lie, the nicotine was a nice pick-me-up. But I also feel something else. The persistent burning sensation in my gum. And eventually, I do also feel a little sick. So, after about a half hour or so, I took some advice from Stromer.
Spit it out before it's too late.
What happens if it's...
Yeah, you might get some nausea, and in worst case, you have to throw up.
Okay.
Well, one pouch was enough for me. About a fifth of Swedes are regular users of snus. Tobacco snus has been banned across the European Union for decades. In 1995, Sweden agreed to join the bloc only after it was given a special exemption. Now, governments across Europe are worried about Sweden's recent product, the nicotine-only pouch I just tried. A few countries have banned sales already, restrictions are being discussed by several others, and next year, France plans to ban nicotine pouches as well.
I try to be a rational person. I cannot understand that kind of stupidity. They got 25% smoking rate in France, 5 times higher than Sweden. They could take a look at Sweden and see what have we done to get to smoke-free generations. But they choose another path.
Tobacco companies like Swedish Match promote snus as an alternative to cigarettes and often point out that Sweden has the lowest smoking rate in Europe. According to the Swedish Match website, the risk of a man dying from tobacco-related illness is less in Sweden than in any other country, even as tobacco consumption is comparable. Snus makers hope that other countries will take notes from the Swedish experience of harm reduction, suggesting that snus contributed to Sweden's low smoking rate.
That's not true. The reason why Sweden has decreased smoking rates are actually classic tobacco control measures.
Lisa Lennartsdotter is a tobacco policy expert with the Swedish Cancer Society. Comparisons with the risks of smoking distract from the risks that come with snus, she says. There are studies that indicate tobacco snus increases the risks of certain types of cancer. But research on the long-term health effects of tobacco snus is limited, and there's barely any research on nicotine pouches. And all that aside, Lennartsdotter says smokers are not the demographic driving sales of nicotine pouches.
The groups that are picking up use the fastest is the young people, and young women especially.
In Sweden, you can buy snus at 18 years old. And according to the Swedish Public Health Agency, about a third of high school-age students in the country now use snus. In 2022, the government introduced new laws restricting the marketing of nicotine pouches to people over the age of 25. But Lennartsdotter says it's not enough to address the problem.
It's very hard to control who is reached by the advertisement, but also... the affordability, the very low price, and together with all these candy-like and fruit flavors, that is a good recipe for young people picking up use.
I reached out to Swedish Match for comment. By email, the company's vice president of communications, Peter Hildingsson, said that Swedish Match has always been clear that those below the legal age should not have access to or use tobacco or nicotine products, and the company works with authorities and retailers to uphold the age limit. He also wrote that two centuries of snus use in Sweden and four decades of research, quote, demonstrated a significant reduction in tobacco-related diseases, and quote, we are also clear that using nicotine products is not without risk and that nicotine is addictive. Anton Ilves just turned 18, and he says that he's been using snus since he was 14 years old.
You get a nicotine rush, you feel like, I don't know, it makes you feel strong. I don't know how, but it's how I feel.
But he says it's a costly habit. About a fifth of his paycheck goes to snus. And using about 5 pouches a day is starting to take a toll on the inside of his mouth.
I notice my gums are very bad right now. Like, it's damaged up here.
So is it, like, pretty sore?
It's... there's, like, dead skin, you know? When you take it out, you can wipe your fingers and there's, like, dead skin all over. But that's only from these nicotine pouches that are very strong.
For now, Ilves says that he'll switch to a lower-strength nicotine pouch, but it's just too addictive to give up for good.
There is a great need of research. We don't know what happens in the body, and we don't know what this local reaction stands for.
Karen Garming-Legert is an oral health researcher and dentist at the Karolinska Institute, Sweden's top medical school.
So if we continue, here's another one. Here we can see an ulcer surrounding by this reddish color, the inflammation, and also this, as we call, white striation, and it's a sign of inflammation in the tissue.
And this is all caused by the white snus or the nicotine pouches, as you say.
Yes.
As a dentist, Garming-Legert tells patients experiencing these symptoms to routinely change the side of the mouth that they keep the nicotine pouch on. It gives the irritated side a chance to heal, she says. And as a snus user herself, she says that she's also had the ulcers.
And I have been doing it for nearly 20 years now. It's embarrassing, actually, because I work with this. But it's quite normal that we use snus in Sweden. And I started with the traditional snus, but I mean, as a lady, you don't want to have this taste or smell from the mouth, you know. So when the nicotine pouches was introduced in Sweden, it was, I mean, a lot of female users started to use the nicotine pouches.
And in her professional and personal opinion, whatever the version of snus, people just shouldn't start. Both Swedish Match and Patrick Stromer at the Swedish Association of Snus Manufacturers said that lesions are a well-known problem to some snus users, and they are reversible. Stromer wrote, quote, whether nicotine pouches have a different impact than snus pouches is too early to say. But if users have problems with the product, he says, it is advisable to quit. For The World, I'm Josh Coe.
Sticking with the youth for a bit, our friends at Deutsche Welle have a regular segment on their Inside Europe podcast. Age is Just the Number is the title. It's young people doing cool things, which they explain in their own voices. Nabil Khan is a 22-year-old medical student from the UK. She founded Skin for All to help people of all races find information on skin conditions affecting them.
Skin for All is my non-for-profit. I started it on my own 3 years ago, literally just in my bedroom, really. And it was a response to the COVID-19 pandemic and the health inequalities that we saw there and just how horrific it actually was for patient experience. And, you know, you had the pandemic statistics, you had the disproportionate amount of Black and ethnic minority staff members dying in the NHS. I couldn't really stand by and just say, that's okay, we'll let inequalities be inequalities. I needed to make a difference. And so that's why I created the website, to create a platform for people to feel seen, heard and respected within medicine, and in particular for Black and brown communities in the UK. I saw it in person, you know, as a medical student, you see that need every single day with the statistics that you see on the news, with the stories you hear from family and friends about the inequalities or the racism that they face when they interact with medical systems. I heard a particularly emotive story about a woman who was constantly undermined. She was constantly told that she didn't have a diagnosis, which she herself had self-diagnosed and said, no, these are the symptoms. This is what I'm appearing with. But she was constantly undermined. And as a result, she was diagnosed really late. And she had unfortunately suffered the complications of that condition. And I think that's really tragic because medicine is all about humans. And if you can't create a service that's for everyone and that represents everyone, what's the point? It took me, I think it was 3 months to complete the website, well, the first draft of the website. And I just wanted to be that platform for change. And I wanted to be that, you know, that platform which people could go to and talk to their friends about saying, you know, have you seen this image? This is exactly what my skin conditions looks like. If you just press on read more or you press a certain condition, what I wanted to focus on was the different elements of a case. And so I focused on things like epidemiology, so essentially how prevalent is that condition. I focus on things like risk factors, if you have potential risk factors that could lead to you having that condition more than others, and things like management. And all of these components aren't meant to replace medical advice. Obviously, I'd say go and, you know, consult your doctor if you are concerned. But it's one of those platforms that just provides education just to make you feel a bit more confident if in a diagnosis, or make you feel a bit more confident in standing up for yourself in healthcare. This is something I'm passionate about, and this is something that makes me happy when I do see the results of it. So it doesn't seem like extra work for me. Thankfully, it's led me to attend some incredible events, such as the One Young World Summit in Munich. But I've also been to the States. So I went to Washington, D.C., and I spoke to the American Medical Student Association, where I received the Racial Justice in Medicine Award. And I was the first British student to ever win it. So that was an incredible feat. And again, a testament to the fact that this isn't just a national issue, it's an international issue. And that demand is still there.
Nabil Khan there, a medical student from the UK. She told her story on DW's Inside Europe podcast. The show is getting ready to celebrate a major birthday. We've been on the air 30 years as of this coming New Year's Day, and we want to hear from you. Head to our website, theworld.org, and let us know what the world means to you. Just click on the banner you see there to send us your message. That's theworld.org. Lots of tradition this time of year, old and new. Our next story serves up tradition from the islands of Cape Verde. Cachupa is a stew made of beans, hominy, and smoked sausage. The longtime favorite appears on kitchen tables and on fancy restaurant menus. Cachupa is attracting a devoted following in Portugal, the country that colonized Cape Verde. Duri Buscarin stepped into the kitchens of Cape Verdean chefs there in Lisbon to learn more.
Back there, you see the process?
Tony Fox calls himself the king of cachupa. But that title might be too humble, he explains, as he fries some onions for a garnish.
But I'm thinking I do too much cachupa, but I'm thinking I'm too small to be king. I want to be importer of the cachupa. I think it's much better.
Once you step inside his restaurant, you understand why he thinks the title Emperor of Cachupa might fit. The stewed meat, tender hominy, and spices blend perfectly into a bowl on a chilly day, topped with a generous dash of homemade hot sauce. It's like coming home to a hug. Fox makes cachupa with fish, cachupa refried with an egg on top. His signature cachupa is lovingly wrapped in a bright green cabbage leaf. Fox says it all started as a bet with a friend.
Yeah, the guy said to me like that, Fox, you don't do cachupa. I said, no, I don't like cachupa, I don't make to do cachupa.
Fox was already a chef. While his parents are from Cape Verde, he was born in Lisbon. He had learned how to make Portuguese food for Portuguese diners. But Fox called his dad, got some advice, called his aunties, catered some events, and people loved it.
This business coming for joking to my friends. Now, everybody know about cachupa.
In the dining room, a group of co-workers share pots of cachupa with a couple carafes of red wine. Elder Cruz was born in Lisbon, but like Tony Fox, his parents are from Cape Verde. He organizes the office cachupa trip every other week.
We always come here, always, because it's good.
For Clara Rodrigue, it was her first time trying cachupa.
A primeira vez que eu provei foi com este grupo
She says she really liked it too, because it reminded her of a chickpea stew from Alentejo, the region of southern Portugal where her parents are from. There's a reason the flavors are familiar to Lisbonites, says Celia Pedroso, a Portuguese food writer. Portugal colonized Cape Verde in 1462 and used it as a stopping point on transatlantic shipping routes.
They were bringing and trading all kinds of food items, plants, and spices.
And human beings. This bloody history created a link between places as far away as Macau, the Indian island of Goa, and Brazil. And the culinary traditions of these places began to evolve together.
In Brazil, they found amazing ingredients they had never seen. And so the corn would become a staple ingredient in Africa and in Cape Verdean food.
Cape Verde won its independence after the fall of Portugal's dictatorship in 1974, and many families moved to Portugal. Pedroso remembers going to Cape Verdean restaurants as early as the 1980s, but only recently, she says, have Portuguese diners really begun to appreciate Cape Verdean food. Her colleague, Ansel Mullins, agrees.
It's definitely a topic of conversation among people who are sort of fanatical about food in Lisbon. It's like, where's your favorite cachupa? That's something that everyone is going to have an opinion on.
Mullins is the founder of Culinary Backstreets, which gives food tours in several cities across the world, including Lisbon. He and Pedroso developed their own food tour in Lisbon to highlight the cuisines of former Portuguese colonies. Shrimp samosas from Goa, cheese puffs from Brazil, popsicles made out of baobab tree nuts from Guinea-Bissau, and of course, cachupa.
It's such an interesting way to understand Portuguese history, and not only that, but Portuguese society.
The strands of this history can also be tasted in a bar called Liquid Love, a bar that started as a love story.
We met at a bar, working in the same bar.
Sheila Tavares' parents are from Cape Verde and Angola. Her partner, Semi Mazouhi, is Tunisian and Italian. They met in London.
And there as well was super multicultural, so we learned how to work with some of the ingredients that are things that we love.
Together, they make cocktails inspired by both their heritage and their travels. For instance, Tavares takes grog, a type of sugarcane rum made by a Cape Verdean company in Lisbon, and combines it with West African and Mediterranean flavors, like coconut, banana, and fig leaf.
It has these notes of the sugarcane, a little bit grassy as well, and sometimes it has these notes of olive brine, too.
She named the drink Morabeza, the Cape Verdean word for hospitality. Tavares grew up in Lisbon. She says she remembers kids at school, judging the lunches her mother packed for her. But now, she says, Portuguese diners are seeking out Cape Verdean food, too.
And now it's being talked about it, and it's being appreciated, and it's being, you know, admired by other people. So it's amazing to see. It's definitely a movement. It's definitely a movement, yeah.
For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin, Lisbon, Portugal.
That story is a favorite from our archives. If you happen to be taking a walk with me in a city and I suddenly stop, there's a good chance that I'm hearing a song and I'm using the Shazam app to find out what it is. I do this a lot. Recently, I was in my local bodega and this was on.
No llevo para mi casa una mujer para cunatana porque puede pensar de que estoy loco lo veo más loco lo.
I learned that it's by Lisandro Meza, a Colombian songwriter, singer, and accordion player, known for songs in the cumbia style. This song is about a woman he wanted to get to know in a nearby village, and the fact that it's blaring in San Diego's Latino community is pretty strong evidence of his impact. But that's also clear from the outpouring of eulogies that ran in Colombia when Meza died in 2023.
El último adiós al maestro Lisandro Meza Márquez se lo dieron en Los Palmitos Sucre, en su tierra natal.
In the TV coverage, the screen says, "Goodbye, entertainer." That's a figure Lisandro Meza cuts for many in Colombia, the quintessential entertainer. He grew up in the northern Caribbean part of the country on his father's tree farm. One of the workers had an accordion, and though he wouldn't let little Lisandro play it, the boy was so curious he managed to pick the lock to the case. He taught himself how to play the instrument when the worker was out cutting trees. Lisandro recorded his first album at the age of 15. can call the style here cumbia, but Lisandro Mesa's genius was combining many different sounds from Latin America and making them danceable together. He called it sabanero, music from the savannas. Not quite a tropical beach vibe, not quite music from the mountains, but something in the middle that drew from both. Leaving you today with a Lisandro Mesa classic. This is Adicción, or Addiction, referring to a woman he can't get enough of. The World comes to you Monday through Friday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org. From PRX.